support further advances for the purpose of establishing the conditions favorable to the decisive invasion of the industrial heart of Japan. Truman had not yet signed on for the Japanese invasion. One of his advisors favored a naval blockade to starve the Japanese to surrender. The president would soon tell the Joint Chiefs that he would judge among his options with the purpose of economizing to the maximum extent possible the loss of American lives. Marshall, with MacArthur concurring from the field, estimated that casualties, killed, wounded, and missing, in the first 30 days following an invasion of the southernmost Japanese home island would not exceed 31,000. An invasion of the main island of Honshu across the plain of Tokyo would be proportionately more violent. When Szilard returned to Washington from South Carolina, he looked up Oppenheimer, just arrived in town for the interim committee meeting, to lobby him. So hard was the Los Alamos director working to complete the first atomic bombs that Groves had doubted 2 weeks earlier if he could break free for the May 31st meeting. Oppenheimer would not for the world have missed the chance to advise at so high a level. But his candid vision of the future of the weapon he was building was as unromantic as his understanding of its immediate necessity was, in Szilard's view, misinformed. I told Oppenheimer that I thought it would be a very serious mistake to use the bomb against the cities of Japan. Oppenheimer didn't share my view. He surprised me by starting the conversation by saying, "The atomic bomb is shit." "What do you mean by that?" I asked him. He said, "Well, this is a weapon which has no military significance. It will make a big bang, a very big bang. But it is not a weapon which is useful in war." He thought that it would be important, however, to inform the Russians that we had an atomic bomb and that we intended to use it against the cities of Japan, rather than taking them by surprise. This seemed reasonable to me. However, while this was necessary, it was certainly not sufficient. "Well," Oppenheimer said, "don't you think that if we tell the Russians what we intend to do and then use the bomb in Japan, the Russians will understand it?" And I remember that I said, "They'll understand it only too well." Stimson's insomnia troubled him on the night of May 30th, and he arrived at the Pentagon the next morning feeling miserable. His committee assembled at 10 a.m. Marshall, Groves, Harvey Bundy, and another aide attended by invitation. But Stimson's attention was focused on the four scientists, three of them Nobel laureates. The elderly Secretary of War welcomed them warmly, congratulated them on their accomplishments, and was concerned to convince them that he and Marshall understood that the product of their labor would be more than simply an enlarged specimen of ordnance. The handwritten notes he prepared emphasized the awe in which he held the bomb. He was not normally a histrionic man. S1. Its size and character. We don't think it mere new weapon. Revolutionary discovery of relation of man to universe. Great history, landmark-like. Gravitation, Copernican theory, but bids fair to be infinitely greater in respect to its effect on the ordinary affairs of man's life. May destroy or perfect international civilization. May be Frankenstein or means for world peace. Oppenheimer was surprised and impressed. When Roosevelt died, he told an audience late in life, he had felt a terrible bereavement, partly because we were not sure that anyone in Washington would be thinking of what needed to be done in the future. Now he saw that Colonel Stimson was thinking hard and seriously about the implications for mankind of the thing we had created and the wall into the future that we had breached. And though Oppenheimer knew Stimson had never sat down to talk with Niels Bohr, the secretary seemed to be speaking in terms derived at some near remove from Bohr's understanding of the complementarity of the bomb. After Stimson's introduction, Arthur Compton offered a technical review of the nuclear business, concluding that a competitor would need perhaps 6 years to catch up with the United States. Conant mentioned the thermonuclear and asked Oppenheimer what gestation period that much more violent mechanism would require. Oppenheimer estimated a minimum of 3 years. The Los Alamos director took the floor, then, to review the explosive forces involved. First-stage bombs, he said, meaning crude bombs like Fat Man and Little Boy, might explode with blasts equivalent to 2,000 to 20,000 tons of TNT. That was an upward revision of the estimate Bethe had supplied the target committee at Los Alamos in mid-May. Second-stage weapons, Oppenheimer went on, meaning presumably advanced fission weapons with improved implosion systems, might be equal to 50,000 to 100,000 tons of TNT. Thermonuclear weapons might range from 10 million to 100 million tons TNT equivalent. These were numbers most of the men in the room had seen before and were inured to. Apparently Burns had not. They worried him gravely. As I heard these scientists predict the destructive power of the weapon, I was thoroughly frightened. I had sufficient imagination to visualize the danger to our country when some other country possessed such a weapon. For now, the president's personal representative bided his time. Entirely in energetic character, Ernest Lawrence spoke up for staying ahead of the rest of the world by knowing more and doing more than any other country. He made explicit a future course for the nation, about which the previous record of all the meetings and deliberations is oddly silent, a course based on assumptions diametrically opposite to Oppenheimer's profound insight that the atomic bomb was shit. Dr. Lawrence recommended that a program of plant expansion be vigorously pursued, and at the same time a sizable stockpile of bombs and material should be built up. Only by vigorously pursuing the necessary plant expansion and fundamental research could this nation stay out in front. That was a prescription for an arms race as soon as the Soviet Union took up the challenge. Arthur Compton immediately signed on. So did his brother Carl. Oppenheimer contented himself with a footnote about materials allocation. Stimson eventually summarized the discussion. 1. Keep our industrial plant intact. 2. Build up sizable stockpiles of material for military use and for industrial and technical use. 3. Open the door to industrial development. Oppenheimer demurred that the scientists should be released to return to their universities and get back to basic science. During the war, he said, they had been plucking the fruits of earlier research. Bush emphatically agreed. The committee turned to the question of international control, and Oppenheimer took the lead. His exact words do not survive, only their summary in the meeting notes kept by the young recording secretary, Gordon Arneson. But if that summary is accurate, then Oppenheimer's emphasis was different from Bohr's, and misleading.
Dr. Oppenheimer pointed out that the immediate concern had been to shorten the war.
The research that had led to this development had only opened the door to future discoveries. Fundamental knowledge of this subject was so widespread throughout the world that early steps should be taken to make our developments known to the world. He thought it might be wise for the United States to offer to the world free interchange of information with particular emphasis on the development of peacetime uses. The basic goal of all endeavors in the field should be the enlargement of human welfare. If we were to offer to exchange information before the bomb was actually used, our moral position would be greatly strengthened. Where was Bohr's understanding that the bomb was a source of terror, but for that very reason also a source of hope, a means of welding together nations by their common dread of a menacing nuclear standoff? The problem was not exchanging information to improve America's moral standing. The problem was leaders sitting down and negotiating a way beyond the mutual danger the new weapons would otherwise install. The opening up would emerge out of those negotiations, necessarily, to guarantee safety. It could not, in the real world of secrecy and suspicion, realistically precede them. In 1963, lecturing on Bohr, Oppenheimer understood well enough the fundamental weakness of his proposal. Bush and Compton and Conant were clear that the only future they could envisage with hope was one in which the whole development would be internationally controlled. Stimson understood this. He understood that it meant a very great change in human life, and he understood that the central problem at the moment lay in our relations with Russia. But there were differences. Bohr was for action, for timely and responsible action. He realized that it had to be taken by those who had the power to commit and to act. He wanted to change the whole framework in which this problem would appear, early enough so that the problem would be altered by it. He believed in statesmen. He used the word over and over again. He was not very much for committees. The interim committee was a committee, and proved itself by appointing another committee, the scientific panel. No one should presume to judge these men as they struggled with a future that even a mind as fundamental as Niels Bohr's could only barely imagine. But if Robert Oppenheimer ever had a chance to present Bohr's case to those who had the power to commit and to act, he had it that morning. He did not speak the Dane's hard, plain truths. He spoke instead as Aaron to Bohr's Moses. And Bohr, though he waited nearby in Washington, had not been invited to appear in the star chamber of that darkly paneled room. Even Stimson thought Oppenheimer's proposals misguided. He asked immediately, what would be the position of democratic governments as against totalitarian regimes under such a program of international control coupled with scientific freedom? As if opening up the world would leave either democratic or totalitarian nations unchanged, a confusion that Oppenheimer's confusion inspired, which led to further confusion. The secretary said it was his own feeling that the democratic countries had fared pretty well in this war. Dr. Bush endorsed this view vigorously. Bush then unwittingly outlined a domestic model of what Bohr's larger open world might be. He said that our tremendous advantage stemmed in large measure from our system of teamwork and free interchange of information, and promptly lapsed back into Stimson's extended status quo. He expressed some doubt, however, of our ability to remain ahead permanently if we were to turn over completely to the Russians the results of our research under free competition, with no reciprocal exchange. Odder and odder, and Burns sitting among them, trying to imagine a weapon equivalent to 100 million tons of TNT, trying to imagine what it would mean to possess such a weapon, and listening to these highly educated men, men almost entirely of the Eastern establishment, of Harvard and MIT and Princeton and Yale, blithely proposing, it seemed, to give away the knowledge of how to make such a weapon. Stimson left to attend a White House ceremony, and they went on to speak of Russia, which Burns knew as an advancing brutality currently devouring Poland, and Oppenheimer again took the lead. Dr. Oppenheimer pointed out that Russia had always been very friendly to science and suggested that we might open up this subject with them in a tentative fashion and in the most general terms, without giving them any details of our productive effort. He thought we might say that a great national effort had been put into this project and express hope for cooperation with them in this field. He felt strongly that we should not prejudge the Russian attitude in this matter. Oppenheimer found an ally, then, in George Marshall, who discussed at some length the story of charges and countercharges that have been typical of our relations with the Russians, pointing out that most of these allegations have proven unfounded. Marshall thought Russia's reputation for being uncooperative stemmed from the necessity of maintaining security. He believed a way to begin was to forge a combination among like-minded powers, thereby forcing Russia to fall in line by the very force of this coalition. Such bulldozing had worked in the gunpowder days, now almost past, but it would not work in the days of the bomb. That power would be big enough, as Oppenheimer's estimates clarified, to make one nation alone a match for the world. The surprise of the morning was perhaps Marshall's idea for an opening to Moscow. He raised the question whether it might be desirable to invite two prominent Russian scientists to witness the Trinity test. Groves must have winced. After the years of secrecy, after the thousands of numb man-hours of security work, that would be a renunciation worthy of Bohr himself. Burns had heard enough. He had sat behind Franklin Roosevelt at Yalta, making notes. In all but the formalities, he outranked even Henry Stimson. He put his foot down, and the seasoned committeeman moved smoothly into line. Mr. Burns expressed a fear that if information were given to the Russians, even in general terms, Stalin would ask to be brought into the partnership. He felt this to be particularly likely in view of our commitments and pledge of cooperation with the British. In this connection, Dr. Bush pointed out that even the British did not have any of our blueprints on plants. Mr. Burns expressed the view, which was generally agreed to by all present, that the most desirable program would be to push ahead as fast as possible in production and research to make certain that we stay ahead, and at the same time make every effort to better our political relations with Russia. When Stimson returned, Compton summed up the sense of the crucial discussion the Secretary of War had missed. The need for maintaining ourselves in a position of superiority while at the same time working toward adequate political agreements. Marshall left them for duty, and the rest of the committee trooped off to lunch. They sat at adjoining tables in a Pentagon dining room. They were a civilian committee. Separate conversations converged on the same question, only briefly mentioned during the morning and not taken up. Was there no way to let this cup pass from them? Must little boy be dropped on the Japanese in surprise? Could their stubborn enemy not be warned in advance, or a demonstration arranged? Stimson, at the focus of one conversation, Burns, the center of the other, may have spoken then of his outrage at the mass murder of civilians and his complicity. Oppenheimer remembered such a statement at some time during the day, and lunch was the only unstructured occasion. Stimson emphasized the appalling lack of conscience and compassion that the war had brought about, the complacency, the indifference, and the silence with which we greeted the mass bombings in Europe and, above all, Japan. He was not exultant about the bombings of Hamburg, of Dresden, of Tokyo. Colonel Stimson felt that, as far as degradation went, we had had it, that it would take a new life and a new breath to heal the harm. The only recorded response to Stimson's mea culpa is Oppenheimer's admiration for it. But there were a number of responses to the question of warning the Japanese or demonstrating the atomic bomb. Oppenheimer could not think of a suitably convincing demonstration. You ask yourself, would the Japanese government, as then constituted and with divisions between the Peace Party and the War Party, would it have been influenced by an enormous nuclear firecracker detonated at a great height, doing little damage? And your answer is as good as mine. I don't know. Since the Secretary of State designate had power to commit and to act, the significant responses to the question are Burns's. In a 1947 memoir, he recalled several. We feared that if the Japanese were told that the bomb would be used on a given locality, they might bring our boys, who were prisoners of war, to that area. Also, the experts had warned us that the static test, which was to take place in New Mexico, even if successful, would not be conclusive proof that a bomb would explode when dropped from an airplane. If we were to warn the Japanese of the new highly destructive weapon in the hope of impressing them, and if the bomb then failed to explode, certainly we would have given aid and comfort to the Japanese militarists. Thereafter, the Japanese people probably would not be impressed by any statement we might make in the hope of inducing them to surrender. In a later television interview, he emphasized a more political concern. The president would have had to take the responsibility of telling the world that we had this atomic bomb and how terrific it was. And if it didn't prove out, What would have happened to the way the war went? God only knows. Someone among the assembled, Ernest Lawrence remembers, concluded that the number of people that would be killed by the bomb would not be greater in general magnitude than the number already killed in fire raids, making those slaughters as a baseline, as indeed before the awful potential of the new weapon, they were. These troubled men returned to Stimson's office and spent most of the afternoon considering the effect of the bombing on the Japanese and their will to fight. Someone unnamed chose to discredit the atomic bomb's destructiveness, asserting it would not be much different from the effect caused by any Air Corps strike of present dimensions. Oppenheimer defended his creation's pyrotechnics, citing the electromagnetic and nuclear radiation it would expel. Dr. Oppenheimer stated that the visual effect of an atomic bombing would be tremendous. It would be accompanied by a brilliant luminescence, which would rise to a height of 10,000 to 20,000 feet. The neutron effect of the explosion would be dangerous to life for a radius of at least two-thirds of a mile. It was probably during this afternoon discussion that Oppenheimer reported an estimate prepared at Los Alamos of how many deaths an atomic bomb exploded over a city might cause. Arthur Compton remembers the number as 20,000, an estimate based on the assumption, he says, that the city's occupants would seek shelter when the air raid began and before the bomb went off. He recalls Stimson bringing up Kyoto then, a city that must not be bombed. The secretary still insisted passionately that the objective was military damage, not civilian lives. The contradiction in Stimson's caveat persisted into his summary of the afternoon's findings, which he offered before he left the meeting at 3:30. After much discussion concerning the various types of targets and the effects to be produced, the secretary expressed the conclusion, on which there was general agreement, that we could not give the Japanese any warning, that we could not concentrate on a civilian area, but that we should seek to make a profound psychological impression on as many of the inhabitants as possible. At the suggestion of Dr. Conant, the secretary agreed that the most desirable target would be a vital war plant employing a large number of workers and closely surrounded by workers' houses, which had been the general formula in Europe. But according to Curtis LeMay, the Japanese worked at home, as families. We were going after military targets. No point in slaughtering civilians for the mere sake of slaughter. Of course, there is a pretty thin veneer in Japan, but the veneer was there. It was their system of dispersal of industry. All you had to do was visit one of those targets after we'd roasted it and see the ruins of a multitude of tiny houses, with a drill press sticking up through the wreckage of every home. The entire population got into the act and worked to make those airplanes or munitions of war. Men, women, children. We knew we were going to kill a lot of women and kids when we burned the town. Had to be done. Stimson had now left the meeting. Arthur Compton wanted to talk about problems at the Met Lab. Before that final discussion, the spirit of Leo Szilard bustled through the room. Groves had just learned of another round of Szilardian conspiracy. The general was wrathful. General Groves stated that the program has been plagued since its inception by the presence of certain scientists of doubtful discretion and uncertain loyalty. Szilard had traveled on to New York after talking to Oppenheimer, and that very morning had looked up Boris Pregel, the Russian-born French metals speculator and bon vivant who had helped out in the early Columbia days and whose mine on Great Bear Lake supplied the Manhattan Project with uranium ore. On May 16th, Szilard had sent Pregel a version of his Truman Memorandum. Groves knew all this from what he calls secret intelligence sources. Meeting with Pregel, fresh from the May 28 meeting with Burns, Szilard had expressed the opinion, says Groves, that someone high in the government, that is, Burns, had been completely misinformed as to Russian sources of ore by the U.S. Army. He claimed that the misinformation was given intentionally. Two could play at sniffing conspiracy. And even in the midst of debate on the necessity of total death in total war, they did. The next morning, June 1st, the interim committee met with four industrialists. Walter S. Carpenter, the president of DuPont, estimated that the Soviet Union would need at least 4 or 5 years to construct a plutonium production facility like Hanford. James White, president of Tennessee Eastman, doubted whether Russia would be able to secure sufficient precision in its equipment to make an electromagnetic separation plant possible at all. George Bucher, the president of Westinghouse, thought that if the Soviets acquired the services of German technicians and scientists, they might build an electromagnetic operation in 3 years. A vice president of Union Carbide, James Rafferty, offered the longest odds, 10 years, to build a gaseous diffusion plant from the ground up, but only 3 years if the Soviets ferreted out barrier technology by espionage. Mentally, Burns added processing time to plant construction. I concluded that any other government would need from 7 to 10 years at least to produce a bomb. From a political point of view, 7 years was a millennium. Stimson still quailed at destroying entire cities with atomic bombs. In the afternoon, absenting himself from the interim committee discussions, he distanced that horror by pursuing the precision bombing question further with Hap Arnold, whom he says he sternly questioned. I told him of my promise from War Department Undersecretary for Air Robert Lovett that there would be only precision bombing in Japan. I wanted to know what the facts were. Arnold told Stimson the one about dispersed Japanese industry. Area bombing was the only way to get at all those drill presses. He told me, however, that they were trying to keep it down as far as possible. Stimson was willing a few days later to pass that tale along to Truman, with a brace of ambivalent motives thrown in for good measure. I told him how I was trying to hold the Air Force down to precision bombing, but that with the Japanese method of scattering its manufacture, it was rather difficult to prevent area bombing. I told him I was anxious about this feature of the war for two reasons. First, because I did not want the United States to get the reputation for outdoing Hitler in atrocities. And second, I was a little fearful that before we could get ready, the Air Force might have Japan so thoroughly bombed out that the new weapon would not have a fair background to show its strength. He said he understood. While Stimson was away, Burns swiftly and decisively co-opted the committee. Mr. Burns felt that it was important there be a final decision on the question of the use of the weapon, recording Secretary Arneson recalled after the war. He described the decision-making process in the minutes he took on June 1st. Mr. Burns recommended, and the committee agreed, that the Secretary of War should be advised that, while recognizing that the final selection of the target was essentially a military decision, the present view of the committee was that the bomb should be used against Japan as soon as possible, that it be used on a war plant surrounded by workers' homes, and that it be used without prior warning. It remained to carry the decision to the president for endorsement. Burns headed straight for the White House as soon as the interim committee adjourned. I told the president of the final decision of his interim committee. Mr. Truman told me he had been giving serious thought to the subject for many days, having been informed as to the investigation of the committee and the consideration of alternative plans, and that with reluctance he had to agree that he could think of no alternative and found himself in accord with what I told him the committee was going to recommend. Truman saw his Secretary of War 5 days later. The president, Stimson noted in his diary, said that Burns had reported to him already about the interim committee's decision, and that Burns seemed to be highly pleased with what he had done. Harry Truman did not give the order to drop the atomic bomb on June 1st, but he appears to have made the decision then, with a little help from Jimmy Burns. After the interim committee meetings on May 31st, Robert Oppenheimer had sought out Niels Bohr. I was very deeply impressed with General Marshall's wisdom, he remembered, in 1963, and also that of Secretary Stimson. and I went over to the British mission and met Bohr and tried to comfort him. But he was too wise and too worldly to be comforted, and he left for England very soon after that, quite uncertain about what, if anything, would happen. Before Bohr left, late in June, he attempted one last time to see a high official of the United States government, Stimson. Harvey Bundy sending in a message on June 18th to the secretary. Do you want to try and work in a meeting with Professor Bohr, the Dane, before you get away this week? At the side of the memorandum, in bold script, whether from exhaustion or impatience or because he understood that the matter had been taken out of his hands, Henry Stimson struck finally, no. No one doubted that Little Boy would work, if any design would.
Otto Frisch's Dragon experiments had proven the efficacy of the fast neutron chain reaction in uranium.
The gun mechanism was wasteful and inefficient, but U-235 was forgiving. It remained to test implosion. While doing so, the physicists could also compare their theory of the progress of such an exotic release of energy with the huge, blinding fact. Trinity would be the largest physics experiment ever attempted up to that time. The hard work of finding a proving ground sufficiently barren and remote and organizing it fell to a compact, close-cropped Harvard experimental physicist named Kenneth T. Bainbridge. His task, the Los Alamos Technical History notes, was one of establishing, under conditions of extreme secrecy and great pressure, a complex scientific laboratory in a barren desert. Bainbridge was well qualified. From Cooperstown, New York, the son of a wholesale stationer, he had worked under Ernest Rutherford at the Cavendish and had designed and built the Harvard cyclotron that now served the Manhattan Project's purposes on the Hill. He had brought back word of the Maud Committee report to Vannevar Bush in the summer of 1941 and had worked at MIT and in Great Britain on radar. Robert Bakker had recruited him for Los Alamos in the summer of 1943. Beginning in March 1944, he took charge of Trinity. He needed a flat, desolate site with good weather, near enough to Los Alamos to make travel convenient, but far enough away to obscure obvious connection. From map data, he chose 8 sites, including a desert training area in Southern California, the Texas Gulf Sandbar region, now known as Padre Island, and several barren, dry valleys in southern New Mexico. Riding 3/4-ton weapons carriers with Robert Oppenheimer and a team of Army officers in May 1944, Bainbridge led an exploration of the New Mexico sites through late snow. Carrying along food and water and sleeping bags, he remembers, they followed unmapped ranch trails past deserted areas of dry farming lands beaten by too many years of drought and high winds. For Oppenheimer, it was a rare escape from the daily burdens of directing Los Alamos, one he was not able to repeat. Several explorations later, Bainbridge chose a flat scrub region some 60 miles northwest of Alamogordo between the Rio Grande and the Sierra Oscura, known ominously from Spanish times as the Jornada del Muerto, the dry and therefore dangerous Dead Man's Trail, the Journey of Death. 210 miles south of Los Alamos, the Jornada formed the northwest sector of the Alamogordo bombing range. With the permission of 2nd Air Force Commander Uzal Ent, Bainbridge staked out an 18-by-24-mile claim. The demands of the implosion crisis in the autumn of 1944 reduced Trinity's priority, says Bainbridge, almost to zero until the end of February 1945. With bomb physics well in hand by then, Oppenheimer set the test shot's target date at July 4th, and Bainbridge got busy. His staff of 25 increased across the next 5 months to more than 250. Herbert Anderson, P.B. Moon, Emilio Segre, and Robert Wilson carried major responsibilities. William G. Penny, Enrico Fermi, and especially Victor Weisskopf served as consultants. The Army leased the David McDonald Ranch in the middle of the Jornada site and renovated it for a field laboratory and military police station. About 3,400 yards northwest of McDonald Ranch, Bainbridge marked out Ground Zero. From that center, at compass points roughly north west and south, at 10,000-yard distances, Corps of Engineer contractors built earth-sheltered bunkers with concrete slab roofs supported by oak beams thicker than railroad ties. N-10,000, 5.7 miles from zero, would house recording instruments and searchlights. W-10,000 would house searchlights and banks of high-speed cameras. S-10,000 would serve as the control bunker for the test. Another 5 miles south beyond S-10,000, a base camp of tents and barracks took shape. A hill named Compania, 20 miles northwest of Zero, on the edge of the Jornada, would serve as a VIP scenic overlook. The Oscuras to the east rose more than 4,000 feet above the high, alkaline plain. The Jornada was host to gray, hard mesquite, to yucca sharp as the swords of samurai, to scorpions and centipedes men shook in the morning from their boots, to rattlesnakes and fire ants and tarantulas. The MPs hunted antelope with machine guns for fresh meat and for sport. Groves authorized only cold showers for his troops. Their isolated duty would win them eventual award for the lowest VD rate in the entire U.S. Army. The well water, fouled with gypsum, made a sovereign purgative. It also stiffened the hair. Contractors built two towers. One, 800 yards south of Zero, they bolted together 20 feet high in trestles of heavy beams, like those that framed the bunkers. It supported a wide platform, like an outdoor dance floor, and one day in early May, the builders returned from a mandated layoff to find it had vanished. Baybridge had seen it stacked with 100 tons of high explosives in wooden boxes, had packed canisters of dissolved, hot Hanford slugs at the center, and before dawn on May 7th, had blown the entire stack, the largest chemical explosion ever deliberately set off, merely to practice routines and try out instruments. The dirt roads had caused delays. He demanded 25 miles of paved roads from Groves as a result and got them, and tightened up procedures for the one and only nuclear test to come. The tower went up at Zero. It had been prefabricated of steel and shipped to the site in sections. Concrete footings poured through the hard desert caliche 20 feet into the earth supported its four legs, which were spaced 35 feet apart. Braced with cross struts, it rose 100 feet into the air, culminating in an oak platform roofed and sheltered on three sides with sheets of corrugated iron. The iron shack's open side faced toward the camera bunker to the west. A removable section at the center of the platform gave access to the ground below. The high iron workers who finished the tower installed bracing at the top for a $20,000 electrically driven heavy-duty winch. Frank Oppenheimer, a Berkeley physics PhD, working for his brother now troubleshooting the test, remembers that when he arrived at Trinity in late May, people were feverishly setting up wires all over the desert, building the tower, building little huts in which to put cameras and house people at the time of the explosion. The reinforced concrete camera bunkers had portholes of thick, bulletproof glass. Hundreds of 6-foot wooden T-poles, strung thick as a loom frame with 500 miles of wire, walked away from Zero to the instrument bunkers, safe miles beyond. Other wires buried underground ran protected inside miles of premium garden hose. Besides photographic studies, three kinds of experiments concerned Bainbridge and his team. One set, by far the most extensive, would measure blast, optical, and nuclear effects with seismographs, geophones, ionization chambers, spectrographs, films, and a variety of gauges. A second would study the implosion in detail and check the operation of the new exploding wire detonators Luis Alvarez had invented. Experiments planned by Herbert Anderson to reveal the explosive yield radiochemically made up the third category. Harvard physicist David Anderson, no relation, arranged to acquire two Army tanks for that work and to pressurize them and line them with lead. Herbert Anderson and Fermi meant to ride them closer to the crater at Zero immediately after the shot, scoop up some of the radioactive debris with a tethered cup hitched to a rocket fired into the crater, and retrieve the material for laboratory measurements. its ratio of fission products to unfissioned plutonium would reveal the yield. By May 31st, enough plutonium had arrived at Los Alamos from Hanford to begin critical mass experiments. Seth Neddermeyer's shell-configured core had been abandoned even though thin-walled shells give the highest compressions in implosion. Designing out their hydrodynamic instabilities required calculations too difficult to accomplish by hand. Berkeley theoretician Robert Christie designed a more conservative solid core, two mated hemispheres, totaling less than one critical mass that implosion would squeeze to at least double their previous density, shortening the distance that fission neutrons would have to travel between nuclei and rendering the mass supercritical. Friesch's group confirmed the core configuration experimentally on June 24th. For the high-density form of PU, the critical mass within a heavy tamper is 11 pounds. Even with a nut-sized central hollow to encapsulate an initiator, the Trinity core cannot have been larger than a small orange. Delivery of full-sized molds for the implosion lens segments paced the test. They began arriving in quantity only in June, and on June 30th, the committee responsible for deciding the test date moved it back to July 16th at the earliest. Kistiakowski's group worked night and day at S-site to make enough lenses. Most troublesome were the air cavities in the interior of the large castings, he recalled after the war, which we detected by X-ray inspection techniques but could not repair. More rejects than acceptable castings were usually our unfortunate lot. Groves met with Oppenheimer and Parsons on June 27th to lay plans for shipping the first atomic bombs to the Pacific. They agreed to send the Little Boy U-235 projectile by water and several U-235 target pieces later by air. The shipping program acquired the codename Bronx because of that New York borough's adjacency to Manhattan. The metallurgists at Los Alamos cast one target piece before the end of June and the U-235 bullet on July 3rd. The next day, Independence Day, the Combined Policy Committee met in Washington and the British officially gave their approval, as the Quebec Agreement provided, for the use of atomic bombs on Japan. Truman had agreed to meet with Stalin and Churchill in the Berlin suburb of Potsdam sometime during the summer. He told Stimson on June 6th that he had succeeded in postponing the conference until July 15th, on purpose, Stimson wrote in his diary, to give us more time. Though Truman and Burns had not yet decided to tell Stalin about the atomic bomb, a successful test would change the Pacific equation. They might not need a Soviet invasion of Manchuria to challenge the Japanese, and might therefore have to trade away less in Europe. To make sure the president had news of the test at Potsdam, Groves decided during the first week in July to fix the test date at July 16th, subject to the vagaries of the weather. He had learned late in June of the possibility of dangerous radioactive fallout over populated areas of New Mexico. "What are you?" he berated the Los Alamos physician who gave him the news. "Some kind of Hearst propagandist?" Or he would not have waited even on the weather. So the shot was set for sometime in mid-July, in the heat of the desert summer, when the temperature on the Jornada often burned above 100 degrees late in the day. Oppenheimer wired Arthur Compton and Ernest Lawrence. "Any time after the 15th would be a good time for our fishing trip, because we are not yet certain of the weather. We may be delayed several days." The senior men arranged a betting pool with a $1 entry fee, wagering on the explosive yield. Edward Teller optimistically picked 45,000 tons TNT equivalent. Hans Bethe picked 8,000 tons. Kistiakowski, 1,400. Oppenheimer chose a modest 300 tons. Norman Ramsey took a cynical zero. When I.I. Robbie arrived a few days before the test, the only bet left was for 18,000 tons. Whether or not he believed that might be the Trinity yield, he bought it. As of July 9th, Kistiakowski did not yet have enough quality lens castings on hand to assemble a complete charge. Oppenheimer further compounded his troubles by insisting on firing a Chinese copy of the gadget a few days before the Trinity shot to test its high-explosive design at full scale with a non-fissionable core. Each unit would require 96 blocks of explosive. Kistiakowsky resorted to heroic measures. In some desperation, I got hold of a dental drill and, not wishing to ask others to do an untried job, spent most of one night the week before the Trinity test drilling holes in some faulty castings so as to reach the air cavities indicated on our X-ray inspection films. That done, I filled the cavities by pouring molten explosive slurry into them and thus made the castings acceptable. Overnight, enough castings were added to our stores by my labors to make more than two spheres. "You don't worry about it," he adds fatalistically. "I mean, if 50 pounds of explosives goes in your lap, you won't know it." Navy Lieutenant Commander Norris E. Bradbury, a brisk, energetic Berkeley physics PhD, took charge of assembling the high explosives. On Wednesday, July 11th, he met with Kistiakowsky to sort the charges according to their quality. The castings were personally inspected by Kistiakowsky and Bradbury for chipped corners, cracks, and other imperfections, writes Bainbridge. Only first-quality castings, which were not chipped or which could be easily repaired, were used for the Trinity assembly. The remainder of the castings were diverted for the Kreutz charge, so named for Edward Kreutz, the physicist who was running the Chinese copy test. The castings were waxy, mottled, brown with varnish. They weighed in total, for each device, about 5,000 pounds. Everyone felt the pressure of the approaching test. It took its toll. "That last week, in many ways, dragged," Elsie McMillan remembers. "In many ways, it flew on wings. It was hard to behave normally. It was hard not to think. It was hard not to let off steam. We also found it hard not to overindulge in all the natural activities of life." In a letter to Eleanor Roosevelt in 1950, Oppenheimer recalled an odd group delusion. "Very shortly before the test of the first atomic bomb, people at Los Alamos were naturally in a state of some tension. I remember one morning when almost the whole project was out of doors staring at a bright object in the sky through glasses, binoculars, and whatever else they could find. And nearby Kirtland Field reported to us that they had no interceptors which had enabled them to come within range of the object. Our director of personnel was an astronomer and a man of some human wisdom, and he finally came to my office and asked whether we would stop trying to shoot down Venus. I tell this story only to indicate that even a group of scientists is not proof against the errors of suggestion and hysteria." By then, the two small plutonium hemispheres had been cast and plated against corrosion and to absorb alpha particles with nickel, which made the assembly, as metallurgist Cyril Smith would write, "beautiful to gaze upon." But an unscheduled change began to be evident 3 or 4 days before the scheduled date. Plating solution, trapped beneath the plating on the flat faces of the hemispheres, began to blister the nickel, spoiling the fit. "For a time," says Smith, "postponement of the whole event was threatened. Completely filing off the blisters would expose the plutonium. The metallurgists salvaged the castings by grinding only part way through the blisters and smoothing the bumpy fit with sheets of gold foil. The core of the first atomic bomb would go to its glory dressed in improvised offerings of nickel and gold." A tropical air mass moved north over Trinity on July 10th, just as the test meteorologist, Caltech-trained Jack M. Hubbard, 39 years old, had predicted. Hubbard had resisted the July 16th date, a Monday, since he first heard of it. He expected bad weather that weekend. The Gulf air suspended salt crystals that diffused a slight haze. On July 12th, worrying about Potsdam, Groves confirmed the test for the morning of July 16th. Bainbridge passed the word to Hubbard. "Right in the middle of a period of thunderstorms," the meteorologist stormed to his journal. "What son of a bitch could have done this?" Groves had been awarded such scurrilous genealogy before. The general's decision started Norris Bradbury and his crews of Special Engineering Detachment GIs, SEDs, the science-trained recruits were called, assembling the Trinity and Kreutz high-explosive charges at two separate canyon sites near Los Alamos Mesa that Thursday. They debated filling the small airspaces between the castings with grease. Kistiakowsky decided against such filler, writes Bainbridge, on the basis that the castings assembled were much better than any previously made, and that the airspaces left by the spacer materials were insignificant. The charges, each of which had been x-rayed one last time and numbered, were papered into snugness instead with facial tissue and scotch tape. The simplified and improved casing of the unit to be tested, which was designated Model 1561, differed from the earlier 1222 casing of bolted pentagons. It featured an equatorial band of five segments, machined from dural castings, to which were bolted large upper and lower domed polar caps. When the explosives that lined the lower hemisphere had been papered into place, Bradbury's SEDs winched down the heavy tamper sphere of natural uranium, which filled the cavity like the pit in an avocado. The tamper was missing a cylindrical plug. The resulting hole would receive the core assembly. The explosive blocks that formed the upper shell followed next. For transport to Trinity, one set of castings was temporarily left out, replaced by a trapdoor plug through which the core assembly could be positioned in the tamper. The reserved castings, an inner of solid composition B, an outer lensed, were boxed separately, with one spare of each type. The men completed preparing the HE assembly for the slow drive down to Trinity by bagging it in waterproof Butvar plastic, boxing it in a braced shipping crate of knotty pine, and lashing the resulting package securely to the bed of a 5-ton Army truck. A tarpaulin then muffled its secrets in inconclusive drape. The plutonium core left the hill first, at 3 that Thursday afternoon, shock-mounted in a field-carrying case studded with rubber bumpers and a strong wire bale. It rode with Philip Morrison in the back seat of an Army sedan like a distinguished visitor, a carload of armed guards clearing the way ahead and another of pit assembly specialists bringing up the rear. Morrison also delivered a real and a simulated initiator. At about 6 o'clock, a sunburned young sergeant in a white T-shirt and summer uniform pants carried the plutonium core in its field case into the room at McDonald Ranch, where it would spend the night. Guards surrounded the ranch house to keep vigil. For security and to encounter less road traffic, the HE assembly would make the trip by night. Kistiakowsky deliberately scheduled that more conspicuous convoy to leave at 1 minute after midnight on Friday, July 13th, to put reverse English on the day's unlucky reputation. He rode in the lead car with the security guards. He soon dozed off and was then startled awake by the scream of the car's siren as the convoy ran through Santa Fe. The Army wanted no late-night drunken drivers rolling out of side streets to collide with its truckload of handmade high explosives. Beyond Santa Fe, the convoy slowed again to below 30 miles an hour. The haul to Trinity took 8 hours, and Kistiakowsky got some sleep. On Friday morning at 9, the pit assembly team gathered in white lab coats at McDonald Ranch and began the final phase of its work. Brigadier General Thomas Farrell was on hand as Groves' deputy, Robert Bacher as the team's senior advisor. Bainbridge looked in. So did Oppenheimer. The ranch house room where the Corps had spent the night had been thoroughly vacuumed in preparation, and its windows sealed against dust with black electrical tape to convert it to a makeshift clean room. On a table there, the assemblers spread crisp brown wrapping paper and laid out the pieces of their puzzle. Two gold-faced, nickel-plated hemispheres of plutonium, a shiny beryllium initiator hot with polonium alphas, and, to confine these crucial elements, the several pieces of plum-colored natural uranium that formed the cylindrical 80-pound plug of tamper. Before assembly began, Bacher asked for a receipt from the Army for the material. It would soon explode. Los Alamos was officially an extension of the University of California, working for the Army under contract, and Bacher wanted to document the university's release from responsibility for some millions of dollars worth of plutonium that would soon be vaporized. Bainbridge thought the ceremony a waste of time, but Farrell saw its point and agreed. To relieve the tension, Farrell insisted on hefting the hemispheres first to confirm that he was getting good weight. Like polonium, but much less intensely, plutonium is an alpha emitter. "When you hold a lump of it in your hand," says Leona Marshall, "it feels warm, like a live rabbit." That gave Farrell pause. He set the hemispheres down and signed the receipt. The parts were few, but the men worked carefully. They nested the initiator between the two plutonium hemispheres. They nested the nickel ball in turn in its hollowed plug of tamper. That required the morning and half the afternoon. Two men lugged the heavy, boxed assembly on a barrow out to the car. It arrived, in its lethal dignity, at zero, at 3:18 p.m. There, Norris Bradbury's crew had been busy with the 5-foot sphere of high explosives Kistiakowski had delivered that morning. At 1 p.m., the truck driver had backed his load under the tower. The men had used a jib winch to lift off the wooden packing crate, had swung it aside and lowered around the sphere a massive set of steel tongs suspended from the main winch, anchored 100 feet up at the top of the tower. With the tongs securing the sphere, its 2 tons were winched up off the truck bed. The driver pulled the truck away, and the winch lowered the preassembled unit to a skid set on the asphalt-paved ground. "We were scared to death that we would drop it," Bradbury recalls, "because we didn't trust the hoist, and it was the only bomb immediately available. It wasn't that we were afraid of setting it off, but we might damage it in some way." Before they opened the upper polar cap to expose the trap door plug, they erected a white tent over the assembly area. Thereafter, a diffused glow of sunlight illuminated their work. "Inserting the plug courted disaster," team member Boyce McDaniel remembers. The high explosive shell was incomplete. One of the lenses was missing. It was through this opening that the cylindrical plug containing the plutonium and initiator was to be inserted. In order to maximize the density of the uranium in the total assembly, the clearance between the plug and the spherical shell had been reduced to a few thousandths of an inch. Back at Los Alamos, 3 sets of these plugs and tamper spheres had been made. However, in the haste of last-minute production, the various units had not been made interchangeable, so not all of the plugs would fit into all holes. Great care had been exercised to make sure, however, that mating pieces had been shipped to Trinity. Imagine our consternation when, as we started to assemble the plug in the hole, deep down in the center of the high explosive shell, it would not enter. Dismayed, we halted our efforts in order not to damage the pieces and stopped to think about it. Could we have made a mistake? Bakker saw the cause and calmed them. The plug had warmed and expanded in the hot ranch house, but the tamper, set deep within the insulation of its shell of high explosives, was still cool from Los Alamos. The men left the 2 pieces of heavy metal in contact and took a break. When they checked the assembly again, the temperatures had equalized. The plug slid smoothly into place. Then it was the turn of the explosives crew. Oppenheimer watched over them, conspicuous in his pork pie hat, wasted to 116 pounds by a recent bout of chicken pox and the stress of months of late nights and 7-day weeks. In the motion picture that documents this historic assembly, he darts in and out of the frame like a foraging waterbird, pecking at the open well of the bomb. Someone hands Bradbury a strip of scotch tape, and his arms disappear into the well to secure a block of explosive. He finished the work in late evening, under lights. The detonators were not yet installed. That would be the next day's challenge after the unit had been hauled to the top of the tower. The following morning, Saturday, around 8, Bradbury supervised raising the test device to its high platform. The openings into the casing where the detonators would be inserted, had been covered and taped to keep out dust. As the bulky sphere rose into the air, it revealed itself generously bandaged, as if against multiple wounds. It stopped at 15 feet, long enough to allow a crew of GIs to stack depths of striped, ticking-covered army mattresses up nearly to its skid, a prayer in cotton batting against a damaging fall. Then it started up again, twisting slowly, seeming on its thin, braided steel cable to levitate, rising the full height of the tower and diminishing slightly with distance as it rose. Two sergeants received it into the tower shack through the open floor, replaced the floor panel, and lowered the unit onto its skid, positioning it with its north and south polar caps at left and right rather than above and below as they had been positioned during assembly, the same posture in which its militant armored twin, Fat Man, would ride to war in the bomb bay of a B-29. The delicate work of inserting the detonators then began. Disaster loomed again that day. The Kreuzgruppe at Los Alamos had fired the Chinese copy, measured the simultaneity of its implosion by the magnetic method, and called Oppenheimer to report the dismaying news that the Trinity bomb was likely to fail. "So, of course," says Kistiakowsky, "I immediately became the chief villain, and everybody lectured me." Groves flew into Albuquerque in his official plane with Bush and Conant at noon. They were appalled at the news and added their complaints to Kistiakowsky's full burden. "Everybody at headquarters became terribly upset and focused on my presumed guilt. Oppenheimer, General Groves, Vannevar Bush all had much to say about that incompetent wretch who forever after would be known to the world as the cause of the tragic failure of the Manhattan Project. Jim Conant, a close personal friend, had me on the carpet, it seemed, for hours, coldly quizzing me about the causes of the impending failure." Sometime later that day, Bacher and I were walking in the desert, and I timidly questioned the results of the magnetic test. Bob accused me of challenging no less than Maxwell's equations themselves. At another point, Oppenheimer became so emotional that I offered him a month's salary against $10 that our implosion charge would work. In the midst of this contretemps, all of Little Boy but its U-235 target pieces slipped away. With two Army officers in escort, a closed black truck, and 7 carloads of security guards left Los Alamos Saturday morning for Kirtland Air Force Base in Albuquerque. A manifest describes the truck's expensive cargo. A. 1 box, weight about 300 pounds, containing projectile assembly of active material for the gun-type bomb. B. 1 box, weight about 300 pounds, containing special tools and scientific instruments. C. 1 box, weight about 10,000 pounds, containing the inert parts for a complete gun-type bomb. 2 DC-3s, waiting at Kirtland, flew the crates and their officer escorts to Hamilton Field near San Francisco, from which another security convoy escorted them to Hunters Point Naval Shipyard to await the sailing of the USS Indianapolis, the heavy cruiser that would deliver them to Tinian. At Trinity, gloom was everywhere. A physical chemist from Los Alamos, Joseph O. Hirschfelder, remembers Oppenheimer's discomfiture that Saturday evening at the hotel where the guests invited to view the test had begun to assemble. "We drove to the Hilton Hotel in Albuquerque, where Robert Oppenheimer was meeting with a large group of generals, Nobel laureates, and other VIPs. Robert was very nervous. He told us about some experimental results which Ed Kreutz had obtained earlier in the day, which indicated that the Trinity atom bomb would be a dud." Oppenheimer searched for